Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. Thank you so much to Scott Gold, who hosted this podcast while I was on vacation playing in the World Series of Poker. I did pretty well. Really, when it comes down to it, I didn't destroy the World Series of Poker. I didn't win a bracelet, but I acquitted myself adequately, and I will return to the World Series of Poker once I can recoup my bankroll and get my head together a little bit. And one of the ways I get my head together is talking about popular culture with some of our writers from the site, and we have a great show for you this week. We're going to talk about new seasons of two fantastic shows on streaming TV. Omar Gayaga will be here to discuss season 2 of House of the Dragon, which is now airing on Max, and William Schwartz will be here to talk about season 4 of The Boys, which is splattering bodies all over Amazon Prime. And we're also going to talk to our film critic Stephen Garrett about The Bike Riders, a really good new movie about 1960s Chicago motorcycle gangs, which is in theaters now. But first, we're going to talk about House of the Dragon, and Omar will be here right after this musical interlude to talk to me about it.
Errors were made in the hours following King Viserys' death.
The war be fought. Many will die. And the victor will eventually ascend the throne.
Just when you thought that there was no more good content on TV or in the movies, a new season of House of the Dragon has debuted on Max. This is the prequel to Game of Thrones. It depicts the internal struggles of the House of Targaryen about 100 years before the action of Game of Thrones takes place, and it is just as salacious and cringeworthy and action-packed as the first couple of seasons of Game of Thrones. Our resident Game of Thrones expert and House of the Dragon expert is Omar Gayaga. He writes a weekly summary of House of the Dragon for the Washington Post, which is a publication that has a slightly smaller circulation than Book and Film Globe, but they got to him first, so he does that for them. And I am a big fan of this show, and so is he, and I'm happy to have Omar Gayaga here today to talk to me about the new season of House of the Dragon. Hello, Omar.
Hey, Neil. Thanks for having me on. This is fun.
Yeah. So House of the Dragon, season 2. The first season, it has a different vibe than the first season, because the first season was about sort of the reign of King Viserys Targaryen, a good king as far as Game of Thrones goes, and one that actually is able to stay on the throne, although he gradually just kind of rotted away before our eyes.
He was not healthy ever. He always had scales on his back or something going on with his health, yeah.
He had something that makes leprosy look like a common cold, whatever he was suffering from. But he's gone now. The king is dead, and there is a new king, and it's his grandson. And there's actually two new rulers, is a king and a queen, and the House of Targaryen is divided.
Actually, it's Viserys's son by Alicent. So Rhaenyra's stepbrother or half brother.
Oh, that's right. I get confused. I get confused because, you know, the thing about the House of Targaryen is that they're kind of incestuous, right? So you never really know who's somebody's uncle or who's somebody's dad. And just because someone's uncle or dad doesn't mean that they can't have sex with them and then have babies with them, apparently. So it's very complicated and very salacious. And I would say the new season is about the power struggle between these two factions of the Targaryens, both of whom have an arsenal of very powerful dragons at their disposal, which makes it even more dramatic.
Yeah, the first season had a big time jump, and it was very much kind of setting up the pieces for this kind of dragon war that's supposed to happen this season. The fourth episode, the episode title has leaked, and it is A Dance of Dragons, which is a reference to this sort of epic battle, which we're anticipating will happen this season. But yeah, the first season was very much like, here's how Rhaenyra got where she is. Here's how Aegon ended up on the throne. You know, here's all the stuff with, you know, Viserys decaying in front of our eyes and kind of setting up this lineage question of, well, he picked Rhaenyra to be his, you know, his successor, but then on his deathbed sort of backtracked and picked Aegon under duress. So like that's the whole kind of crux of the second season is like, well, who's really supposed to be on the throne? And now they're killing each other's children on both sides. And it's, you know, it's inflaming the call to war. There's a lot of scheming and trying to kill each other behind the scenes. And this season, it took a little bit, I thought, for the first season to get going. I thought it took a good 3 or 4 episodes before it really kind of hit its stride and started getting bonkers the way I like these shows to be. The complaint I'm hearing about this season and the show overall is that it's lacking the depth of character that we had with Game of Thrones. And I think I know the answer to that. I don't know if you want to weigh in on that first.
I think that's incorrect. I think that the characters, I mean, look, the problem is that we know where this is a prequel. So we know of basically where it's leading. So, a crazy Targaryen being on the throne and the rest of Westeros having to unite to defeat him. And I know we're generations away from that, but that is gradually what we're working towards. So, there's that. But I don't think that that's true necessarily. I mean, it is true that it's a little more concentrated, right? Like Game of Thrones had all these different factions in all these different places with all these different aesthetics. And House of the Dragon, for the most part, although we do visit the North in the first episode, there's some bouncing around from castle to castle. Doesn't have that, right? It's a little more concentrated on the Targaryen family.
It's starting to do a little more of that, a little as they're sort of trying to kind of build their factions and kind of, you know, you're seeing a little bit more of these other areas like Winterfell and places like that where they're trying to kind of get that support from these factions. But the depth of character thing, I think, has to do with that. What we're watching right now is based on sort of a history book, basically. Like George R. R. Martin wrote a history book of this era, whereas the Game of Thrones episodes were based on novels. You know, they were four or five novels or whatever. You know, the one that's not finished, but those were very much, you know, you got in the characters' heads. You kind of could, you know, got their histories, you know, over multiple books. You know, so you had a lot of backstory of all those characters. With this book, like they're basically, the show is having to make up a lot of their emotions and how they're feeling about things, because it was a very straightforward history book that this is based on. Like this happened and then this happened and then this led to this war. You know, it was not written internally the way the Game of Thrones books are. So
right. But I still think there are some excellent scenes. You know, I thought the second episode, which I watched last night, there is a very great, well-written scene, I thought, between Rhaenyra and Daemon Targaryen, the niece and uncle who are married and are in charge of one of the factions. I thought that was very well-written, very well-acted. And there's a good and moving scene between the Hightowers. Allison Hightower is married, is the mother of the king, and her father is this sort of schemer who put all this into motion, and now I think he's starting to regret.
Yeah, Otto. Otto Hightower.
He's regretting what he started, because he realized that he sort of set something into motion that he can't stop.
I think where the show is stumbling, and people are enjoying it. You know, it's a big spectacle. There's not really any other show on TV like it right now, except for maybe the Lord of the Rings things on Amazon that nobody's watching. But I think Game of Thrones was a lot better about showing us these motivations and showing us how the characters were feeling, and not just explaining to us in verbiage, well, you must be doing this because you feel this way and you're still upset about this thing, which is basically what that scene was with Rhaenyra and Daemon, was her telling us his motivations and what he's feeling, which the show has not shown us at all I think the portrayals are great. I think the acting is great, but the show has not shown us that, you know, that that's what Daemon, you know, is thinking. We had to have Rhaenyra tell us that, you know, to understand it.
What it does do is it builds the first two episodes have both built to these sort of enormously tense set pieces at the end. The first episode was the crawl through the castle to try to find someone to kill. And the second episode was this epic fight between these two brothers, these twins. I'm finding it a lot of fun. I love this world. I love the fact that in Game of Thrones, like, no, you can't get, don't get too attached to any one character, because they may not be around much longer, especially if they seem like they're noble and they have good intentions. And, you know, you're getting everything that you want from Game of Thrones. There's lots of dirty sex. There's lots of action and blood. There's a lot to cringe at, basically.
It's much more complex. I mean, much less complex than Game of Thrones, which I think that's one, if you're not a hardcore George R.R. Martin person or someone who's really, really, you know, who read the books, it feels like a much lighter experience, but with all of the, you know, big budget, you know, spectacle of it, all the special effects and all of the dragon shit and all of the sex and all, like, all that's there. What I think it's lacking a bit that Game of Thrones had was just that feeling that this could go on for, you know, 6, 7, 8 seasons. Like, I don't feel like this show has that much runway.
No, I think, well, they did renew it for a third season.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, it'll go a few seasons, but I don't think there's enough, unless they do what they did with Game of Thrones, where they had to start making it up as they went along. Like, I don't know that there's enough story, you know, on what this is based on for them to kind of continue it indefinitely.
Well, there doesn't need to be, right? Because the Game of Thrones is now a universe, and they're going to continue to give us stories from that universe, and they don't need to Game of Thrones went on, some would argue, maybe a season or two too long. They don't need to give us the entire world because we already have that in the original Game of Thrones. That show took us everywhere we could possibly ask for.
Yeah, and I think there's two shows in the works that are going to, you know, like other time periods and other stories. So yeah, definitely, like, HBO is very invested in this universe, and they're definitely not going to let it lie fallow the way they did between Game of Thrones and this show. I think they're going to want stuff in the hopper at all times, you know, to keep it going.
Yeah, well, the George R.R. Martin fantasy universe is now here to stay. I feel like, it sounds like I like House of the Dragon just a little bit more than you do there, Omar. Maybe my standards are low. You know, maybe I'm just not looking for something. I mean, yes, is it the greatest TV show ever made? It is not. But it is welcome, especially after the later seasons of Game of Thrones, to have something that is nice and tight and competent.
Well, I get dinged on the recap comments and on the Washington Post as like, oh, you must hate this show. You know, this must be a terrible assignment for you. You must feel tortured, you know, writing these recaps. I'm like, no, I'm actually having a good time because I don't take the show that seriously. I don't, you know, examine it with a microscope the way the fans do. And I haven't read the source book. I on purpose did not read it. And so I don't have, I'm not saying, well, they changed this and this is different from the book. Like, I'm not basing any of my criticisms on that. But I think my one hang up with it right now, you know, as you know, going into third, fourth episodes, is that I feel like the characters are not evolving. They're just like they're just the one thing. Damon is, he's pissy and mad and, you know, and always going to be bitter and scheming. Rhaenyra is always going to be, you know, focused on getting to the throne no matter what. I don't feel any that the characters are questioning themselves or, you know, having any doubts about what they're doing, the way some of the characters used to on Game of Thrones, where there was a little bit more complexity. That's my biggest problem, but that's not to say I'm not enjoying it.
I consider it like an R-rated fantasy romp, sort of Shakespeare light, you know? It has Shakespearean themes, but is not in fact Shakespeare. So I would agree with your assessment. But it's certainly, like, there are very few shows in our household that are destination viewing, and House of the Dragon remains one of them. So, and I know it will be for you, especially because you're getting paid to watch it, which is really everyone's dream.
I'm in for the long haul, yeah.
That's the best thing about this job, is I get paid to watch TV and movies. I mean, please let me do this for the rest of my life.
I will say the first season really won me over about midway through, when it started being more about the battles and the people getting beheaded in the court, you know, like okay, this is the bonkers crazy show that I wanted in the first place. I think that's probably what's happening with this season too. Is like, it's a lot of the first couple episodes are going to be a lot of scene setting, a lot of like getting all these things lined up, and then things are going to go bonkers. You know,
the dragon fights are coming, Omar. Don't worry.
Yeah, I think we're in for it.
All right, Omar Gayaga, thank you so much. House of the Dragon is airing now on Max. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Dale.
I know you. What the hell do you have planned? Bot has no idea what's coming. If you're willing to help us with this, we just might get to finish off those bastards. Once and for all. Hell of a day, huh? She's still home.
House of the Dragon is not the only pop culture property to have a new season this month. We also have season 4 of The Boys, the extremely popular superhero parody show on Amazon Prime. And The Boys is an interesting show because it as William Schwartz pointed out in the pages of Book and Film Globe, it is not only a satire of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and of DC content, but it also has kind of become its own universe of content. There's a spin-off show, and the characters are as popular as the mainstream superheroes that it makes fun of. And so that puts the boys in kind of an odd cultural position. And William Schwartz is here with me today to talk about the new season of The Boys. Hello, William.
Hello.
Hello. Yes. So one of the things you pointed out that was very interesting in your piece was that, you know, The Boys is a satire of contemporary superhero culture, and it also makes fun of contemporary politics. And this season, it really leans into making fun of, you know, the Trumpist right and the alt-right to a great degree. And Homelander, the show's sort of main superhero character, is kind of a Trump manqué. And this has made a lot of people angry. And I'm watching the show, and I'm just kind of wondering why. What is really so offensive here? I mean, I still find it kind of funny and pointed, and I'm not a particularly ideological person.
Well, I think what does it is that it is The Boys occupies this very odd place in terms of what side that the writing appears to be on, because on one end, it does do the very obvious, not terribly subtle, anti-Trump stuff to like the extent of far right-wing religious extremists, the firecracker character who is running her own Total Crank podcast, all sorts of weird stuff like that. But the other very odd and very weird thing that it does that gives people mixed signals is that it also mocks woke culture a lot. It mocks the idea of, you know, corporate diversity and, you know, how that's supposed to be making a better world or whatever. It's very open about the idea that this is all, you know, just total nonsense. It isn't actually improving anything. It's just a really obviously cynical way for corporations to try to make themselves seem as if they are, you know, on the right side. I mean, one of the interesting things about a lot of the social media content, or like the Amazon Prime X-ray vision feature or special extras of The Boys, is that it's all over the place in terms of whether the Vought Corporation is like just a generic corporate stooge, whether they're an ultra woke diversity loving organization. It changes all the time. The bit is constantly shifting and it is never particularly consistent. So really it just depends on which part you best remember, or on which part you best identify with, whether you even think this is even a leftist or a rightist show. Like, because in general, entertainment reporters or critics of the like are liberal, they only generally ever ask about the Trumpist aspects. They don't ask questions about like what the show is saying about Me Too, because that gives you into very bleaker directions. The show's overall arc about stuff like Me Too has very much been pretty much that it obviously didn't work. And that isn't to say, of course, that sexually assaulting subordinates is good, obviously. But the impression is kind of given that, you know, simply saying that you love diversity, saying that you love telling stories about coming up from bad backgrounds or whatever, it isn't necessarily anti-racist. In fact, it can be quite racist, in fact. And none of that is even necessarily at odds with Trumpism. So you can see how a Trumpist would find these to be a very mixed message.
Yeah, I mean, I see the show. I mean, the show obviously is making fun of Trumpism. I mean, episode two, they go, the boys are sort of anti-superhero, you know, CIA assault squad, go to an alt-right conference at a hotel, and they find all kinds of crazy, you know, conspiracy theories. They're making fun of Pizzagate and, you know.
Half of which are true.
Yeah.
Is one of the funny things about it.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And that's why it's such a good satire. And having an alt-soup character in Firecracker, I think, is extremely clever and extremely apt. So it's making fun of all that. And Homelander is obviously kind of learning some Trumpist lessons in manipulating public opinion from the quote-unquote smartest woman in the world who is aligned with him, sort of like Steve Bannon, like a young black female Steve Bannon character, just manipulating everything behind the scenes. But you also have like a satire of liberalism. I mean, Starlight, who is your main good guy superhero, has formed this completely weak-kneed foundation and obviously has no idea what she's doing. And also, there's a superhero who has managed to manipulate herself into the vice presidency, who is obviously, if not exactly, modeled on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, You know, she looks like her to some extent. She espouses the same sort of rhetoric. And so I feel like, you know, The Boys is one of those shows where the writers of the show and the creators of the show are smarter, really, and more than one step ahead of the critics.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that. But I mean, a lot of this stuff also really does kind of get out of hand and out of control. You know, when that first character first shows up, our AOC-like character, this was like during the very height of AOC hype when people thought she might, you know, challenge Democratic leadership or something like that. She is a parody of that very now very antiquated image of AOC, you know, where she's just this really talented, smart schemer, which the actual AOC really simply is not at this point. I don't think anybody can really act like, you know, she's anything like that. It's still on point, the idea that, you know, a person like AOC could, in theory, manipulate the whole situation in such a way for personal gain. But, I mean, in general, the entire situation is too incoherent. Our whole real-world situation is a lot more incoherent than really makes much sense. And, I mean, this is part of why I think The Boys is able to resonate so much, because so often the explanations are stupid. And it's not that the explanations are wrong. It's just the core situation itself is really stupid.
Yeah, agreed. And The Boys, you know, the core situation in The Boys is also messy and stupid. And you can never quite figure out, you know, who's on what side and who's doing the right thing or why. And so, you know, that said, it's still sort of the same show, right? Like Homelander is one of the greatest characters ever on TV. I mean, Anthony Starr, the Australian actor who plays this sort of evil Superman, evil neurotic Superman, is just fantastic. And, you know, continues this season to just every scene he's in just lights up the screen. I'm sort of find myself growing tired of some of the side characters. You know, surprisingly, Carl Urban's Billy Butcher this season, I'm so bored whenever, you know, I find myself looking at my phone whenever he's on the screen. I'm just tired of his shtick. I find myself waiting for the scenes when, you know, Homelander or The Deep come back on, because they are still, to me, the characters with the most juice. I do love this firecracker character, and I like the smartest woman in the world, even though, you know, she herself, I mean, it's hard to make someone the smartest person in the world when the writers themselves are not the smartest people in the world, right?
It's one of the bigger questions in our culture right now. How much does smartness really matter? How much is smartness really that helpful? Can we really look at the world around? And, you know, this is kind of like her whole thing. It remains ambiguous.
Because to me, she just seems like kind of an above average political strategist, not the smartest person in the world.
Yeah.
You know, when you watched Watchmen, that guy, Ozymandias, that guy is clearly the smartest person in the world, like way beyond like intelligence of normal people. Whereas this character, I'm not really seeing it yet.
It's definitely one of those cases where until you actually get to the end of the season and it's not totally clear what her exact motivations are. Is this the message here basically being that smart people might be stupider than they look? Like pure smartness doesn't actually matter. Does she have some kind of overly complicated fourth dimensional chess, whatever going on? We really don't know, but that's a big part of what makes it interesting, because usually the person whose superpower is being super smart is not generally portrayed in this Bannon-esque campaign manager type way. They usually are like do hard science. They're making like inventing ray guns or spaceships or whatever, you know, like the Reed Richards, Tony Stark kind of archetype. That's how that kind of superpower usually manifests. It's actually pretty rare to see a character who's smart, not in some technical sense, but in terms of a social sense, like doing Sherlock Holmes-esque types of deductions. This is part of what makes the character interesting, because as we've seen from Sherlock Holmes adaptions, of which we always have constantly, just because you are smart at doing a certain kind of thing doesn't mean that you're smart at everything. And Sage in particular is really comically misanthropic. And she also clearly holds woke culture in about as much contempt as everyone else, despite the fact that she herself is Black, despite the fact that she herself also hates racists quite a bit, because, again, it's all nonsense. That's a lot of what the basic idea of The Boys is expressing, that a lot of these smart ideas that we try to associate with our culture, with superhero culture, political culture, or whatever, they're not really based on anything. They're built on a foundation of stupid ideas, and that's a big part of what makes The Boys so appealing, because even if the satire is not deep, it is very painfully accurate to the extent of showing that, well, everything is just based on an idea of corporate profit that might not even be profitable.
Yeah. Well, let's also be clear. Like, I feel like the show is still very sharp, still very funny. There's plenty of gross out stuff, both in terms of violence and sex, which is sort of the hallmark of The Boys. There hasn't been a ton of exciting action in this season thus far. I mean, last season when you had, Homelander and Soldier Boy going at it, there was a ton of superhero action. That may still be coming, but I would say that The Boys has not really lost a step and remains, you know, one of the most entertaining and vital shows on TV.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, I've seen farther ahead than most people, so I've got a better idea of what's coming. And, well, I mean, the flying sheep was in the trailer, so you'll get to that eventually.
Are we going to be disappointed? It doesn't sound like it.
No, I would say no. It's exactly what it sounds like.
All right, sounds good. And I'm looking forward to seeing the flying sheep. All right, William Schwartz wrote about The Boys season 4 for us on Book and Film Globe. And William, I look forward to your next piece and to talking to you soon.
Certainly, always a pleasure.
All those clubs do is sit around talking about motorcycles.
That's what we do.
You ready?
Nice and all.
I like you guys.
You're in.
Our movie of the week is The Bike Riders, directed by Jeff Nichols. This is a kind of a curious artifact because it is a historical drama about a 1960s Chicago motorcycle gang. Well, they're not really a gang. They're more like a club that kind of turns into a gang. And the movie is based on a book, a journalistic book about a similar club. It has a different name. I think in the book it's called The Outlaws, and in the movie they're called The Vandals. But this journalist was part of the gang in the 60s, and he took a lot of photos and did a lot of interviews. And the movie, I saw something before the movie that said that 70% of the dialogue in the film is drawn from this book, and a lot of the imagery is right also drawn from the book. So the movie has like kind of a verisimilitude that a lot of these kinds of movies don't. Anyway, Stephen Garrett is here. I know I'm talking a lot. Hello, Stephen. And he's part of my motorcycle gang.
My motorcycle club, yeah.
I've only been on a motorcycle once. I went back when I was writing about cars more often. I one time did a story on these motorcycle races called MotoGP. They're kind of like the Grand Prix of motorcycle racing, and one of the best MotoGP riders drove me around a dirt track for a few minutes on the back of his bike. It was terrifying, and I'll never get on a motorcycle again. So I'm not a good candidate for a motorcycle gang. You're probably also not a motorcycle.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, I haven't, and I have a friend who loves motorcycles, and I remember riding. I must have. This is back in college, and I was very uncomfortable. I'm not made for that kind of transportation. No, it's too exposed. I don't understand why it's enjoyable.
Well, the people in this movie are really exposed because it's 1965, and I guess the movie ends in like the early 70s. But they're not riding around they're not wearing helmets. They're just wearing leather jackets and a lot of Brill Cream. And
looking pretty badass.
Looking dirty.
It's a good looking. I mean, I think this is more a vibes movie. I don't know. I'll let you speak. But that was my hot take, was that like it just felt good to live in this world. And then by the end, I was like, so what's the point? But I loved watching movie stars. They're just movie stars looking cool.
Yeah, looking cool and getting into fights. Well, yeah, I would say I liken this in my review, which I reviewed this for Book and Film Globe. It's sort of like reading a Village Voice article or a Chicago Reader article from that era. You're kind of getting you get a sense of the world and the kind of the eccentric characters who are in it. And, you know, I'd say that, you know, there's three main characters, right? There's Johnny, played by Tom Hardy, who's this truck driver who starts this motorcycle gang after he watches Marlon Brando in The Wild One on Black.
And he's like, he's a family man, right? Yeah. He's married, he's got kids,
he's got a job. And then you've got Benny, played by Elvis himself, Austin Butler, who's he's like a James Dean-like character. He's a drifter who really is dedicated to the bike riding lifestyle and doesn't seem to have a job or any kind of personality.
He loves it. He's very dedicated to his hair, too. His hair looks amazing.
And then the real star of the movie is Jodie Comer, who plays Kathy, who is she's just a working-class Chicago gal who ends up at a bar where the bike riders are, and she ends up marrying Benny, Even though the two of them don't really seem to have any actual chemistry or even kiss one time. Yeah. But Jodie Comer, I will say, I lived in Chicago a long time, and she is very plausible as a Chicago dame. Straight out of a Nelson Algren novel, as far as I'm concerned. She's great, and the movie seems to spend a lot of time just kind of lost in her big eyes.
I had a hard time
extricating myself as well. She is fantastic in it, but I would say, you know, the movie itself, like, doesn't, I enjoyed watching it pretty much from beginning to end. Also, Michael Shannon is in it, and he plays this kind of weirdo who, like, goes off on these monologues.
As per usual. You forgot Mike Feist. He's the reason for the season, man. He's the reason. He plays the photographer that the book is based on, right?
In it. But the problem with the movie is that, you know, I mean, Kathy is, it's all pretty much interviews with her, and then occasionally he'll go off and he'll talk to, like, a side character, either Michael Shannon or there's a guy played by Boyd Holbrook, also very good. Really, really great cast. But the main two characters, Benny and Johnny, he never interviews them or interacts with them in any way, which is kind of strange considering it's really their story. And there are plenty of scenes involving them where Mike Feist isn't around. And, you know, like, you kind of hear Kathy's narration a little bit, but how would she know this? And, you know, so there's certain elements of the narrative conceit that don't quite work. I'm probably nitpicking here because, you know, like you said, the whole point of the movie is to vibe with this gang and to ride around with them and to sort of, you know, get a sense of what their lives are like and how biker culture changed from the sort of early to mid 60s, to the early 70s when it got a little more drug influenced, a little more violent, tracing, you know, that the breakdown of the summer of love as it turned into Altamont, basically.
I kind of love that part. And Jodie Comer's character doesn't feel threatened really ever around them. She thinks they're kind of dangerous, but they really kind of look out for her. And then suddenly they don't. Right?
Until the hippies show up.
Yeah.
The hippie bikers.
The dark hippie bikers.
The long-haired, junky scumbag bikers, as opposed to just the sort of the, you know, leader of the pack, greaser style bikers. These guys are rough, but they're really just in it because they love motorcycles and they like beer and they like punching each other.
It's like conservative bikers versus liberal bikers. It's like, they're like good family men. They're good Christian men driving around on their bikes and getting in fights.
Yeah. Except for Austin Butler's character who's just a loner troublemaker. And you never, I mean, Johnny has a complete story arc, I will say this, but you never really get a sense of, like, who Austin Butler is, where he came from, why he's doing it, where he's going. There's one moment where he sort of breaks down crying after something major happens. But, you know, other than that, it's like, he's kind of he's good. He's very easy to watch, Austin Butler, but it's kind of a one-note performance at the same time.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, his courtship of her, I mean, it's kind of delight. I really dug it. It was very, very sensuous and very, like, you know, he's kind of this hotshot guy, and she kind of falls for it. I don't know. There was just something, like, I found it very alluring. The whole world and the way that he kind of wins her. And the way she falls for him, you know? And also, I mean, the production design, too, is, like, incredible, right? It's so
excellent.
Visceral.
Excellent.
Oh, they got every detail right.
It's drawn. I mean, Jeff Nichols, I felt like, did a really great job. He sort of recreated these photographs. And it really it doesn't feel fake. And I think part of that, too, is that, you know, he doesn't, there's not a lot of melodramatic music. He uses a period-appropriate soundtrack, but doesn't overuse it. I think this is a really good movie. I have to say, like, I'm nitpicking some of its story flaws, but I really feel like it, you know, it does a great job of capturing this subculture, and I recommend it. I recommend it pretty highly. I mean, it is a strong piece of work. You know, I wasn't super familiar with this filmmaker. You mentioned other movies he'd done include Mud, which is a Matthew McConaughey.
He did a, you know, I think he got on people's radars. He did this thing called Shotgun Stories, which I did not see. But then he made a movie called Take Shelter a few years ago, which kind of, I think, was most notable also for having a big role for, Jessica Chastain That was like one of her big movies, kind of around the same time as the, you know, Tree of Life.
Yeah. And then Loving.
A movie called Mud that I was not crazy about. But Loving, yeah, Loving I thought was great.
Loving was the story of the court case that legalized interracial marriage in the United States. And I feel like, look, I mean, interracial marriage and motorcycle clubs, not the same, not the same in terms of story matter, but he did a nice
period piece.
Period piece.
You know, both 60s, right? Late 60s. Yeah. You could probably intercut the movies and they're both kind of happening at the same time.
Yeah. And, you know, Loving, as I was saying to you via text message, featured a substantial role for Nick Kroll as a lawyer. If they'd stuck Nick Kroll in Bike Riders, it would have been a problem.
That would have been a little hard to swallow.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
A big, too much tuna. it would have been a big problem. But instead, you have Tom Hardy, who's, you know, his accent is ridiculous, but he does, you know, he really is believable as this tough guy. Sort of a man of few words, and Austin Butler, I guess is, I don't know. I also think Norman Reedus is in this and he's terrific. So it's a really great cast.
It's a great cast.
Really great cast. Really nice, really well-made movie. And I don't think it's going to be like the summer's a big hit of the summer or anything, but it's nice to see, them open an adult, theme, not an adult movie, that's not what I mean, but it, like a movie aimed at adults, you know, in the middle of the summer. And you know, it's a movie of what I consider this movie to be pretty high quality.
I agree. I think you're maybe a little more high than I am on it. I think it's solid. I think it's fine. Solid. I think it really like just, God, the atmosphere and the, like I say, it's like a vibe movie. It's just, that lingered more than the story. And I kind of wish the story had more substance for me to care more about the movie, but as it is,
it's more like a sort of visual version of an oral history than a movie itself. I will give you that. But I don't think we're ever going to get a better film about 1960s Chicago motorcycle clubs.
That's fair.
This is the final word. It's The Bike Riders. It is in theaters now, and I'm sure it will be on streaming imminently. It gets a high recommendation from me. And also, I think Stephen, if you were to watch it again, you would like it even
worthwhile.
A little
bit. Worth seeing. And I agree with you. It's great kind of programming for the summer. And you know, go see it. It's not a cartoon. It's a real real event, real life. It's like your clothes are going to smell like smoke and booze after you see it.
Yeah, well, mine already do because I was just in Las Vegas for 9 days. So no change there. And that's why they call me the leader of the pack.
There you go.
All right. Thank you so much, Stephen Garrett. The Bike Riders is in theaters now. Also, thank you to William Schwartz for talking to me about the new season of The Boys on Amazon Prime, and to Omar Gayaga, our resident House of the Dragon expert, for joining me to talk about season 2 of House of the Dragon, which is airing on Max. I am Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, and the 669th best over 50 poker player in the world. That's a great honor that the World Series of Poker bestowed upon me in the last week. You can find our site at www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV every day, and I record this podcast every week, and I thank you for joining me, and I will see you on the site, at the movies, watching TV, reading books, and of course, at the poker tables. I'll talk to you soon.
Original production.